Hello, I'm Mike Easterly, staff member with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm here with Donald Cohn at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Donald Cohn, until recently, was the vice chairman of Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Board. So everyone knows here that this interview is being taped, and Dr. Cohn, you consent to being taped?
I do.
Okay, great. Now, everyone in the room will identify himself. I'm Mike Easterly, a staff member with the FCIC.
Tom Stanton, with the research staff of the FCIC.
Bruce McWilliams, FCIC.
Stephen Mintz, FCIC.
Dave Caperton of the Legal Division at the Federal Reserve Board.
And Donald Cohn. Now, some background information about the commission. The commission was established by statute and signed into law by the president. There are 10 commissioners. All of them come from outside the government, and it is a bipartisan commission, and Congress has charged the commission with examining the causes of the financial crisis and examining the causes of the collapse of major financial institutions that failed or would have likely failed had they not received exceptional government assistance. The commission is to provide a report containing the findings and conclusions of the commission to the president and the Congress by December 15th, and the commission may require, by subpoena or otherwise, the attendance and testimony of witnesses and the production of books, records, correspondence, memoranda, papers, and documents. Do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. And also, I'm compelled to mention that Section 1001 of Title 18 of the United States Code applies, which makes it a federal crime to knowingly and willfully falsify, conceal, or cover up by any trick, scheme, or device a material fact, or make any false, fictitious, or fraudulent statements or representations. Now, I have no reason that you would engage in any trick, scheme, or device, but I'm compelled to say that.
I understand.
Okay. And
actually, remember that from the Solomon Brothers bidding crisis, because that was the law that they broke by lying to the government about who was bidding on the government security.
Interesting. Okay. And some general instructions. If you don't understand a question or if it is clear, please tell the questioner, and we will try to restate it. If you need a break at any time, just let us know, and we can finish up questions and then come back later.
Sure.
And as to historical facts, this is something you asked about. We're just looking for your best recollection.
Okay.
Be precise as you can, also give us your best estimate if you don't know.
Okay.
All right. And Mike, I'd like to say for the record that this is covered by our confidentiality agreement between the board and the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Okay.
What's that?
We have a confidentiality agreement so that if any confidential information is shared, they have to go through a certain process before releasing it.
That. Okay. Thank you, Dave.
All right, and the way we usually start is for you to give a brief account of your career starting just after college. This is for the record.
Okay. So I graduated from the College of Worcester in 1964, and I went to the University of Michigan where I got my Ph.D. The degree was granted in 1971, but I left the university at the end of 1969 and took a job with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, and started in January 1970. 1975, I came back here to the Board of Governors on the staff of the Division of Research and Statistics. Rose through a series of promotions there. Ended up as deputy to the staff director for monetary and financial policy, which was a separate little office from research and statistics. When he left and the heads of Division of Research and Statistics left, there was some shuffling around, and they created a separate division for me called Division of Monetary Affairs in 1987. I was director of that division until either 2000, 2001, something like that. I was secretary of the Federal Open Market Committee over that period, actually from mid-86, I think, to 2000 or 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I was a senior advisor to the board for monetary policy for a year or two, And then in 2002, I was appointed to the board as a governor. And in 2006, I was appointed as a vice chairman of the board.
Okay.
And I retired. My last day at work was September 1st, 2010.
All right.
I am now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Okay. Thank you. Most of the questions that I have to ask are about the so-called shadow banking system and disintermediation and the Fed's policy towards that. Around 1980, what were the Fed's thoughts about the money market mutual funds?
So I don't... the Federal Reserve's interest in the money market mutual funds, from my perspective, mm-hmm. that I was involved in, had to do with their interest as competitors with the banks for, in effect, transaction funds. Mm-hmm. So in 1980, we were targeting M1 as a means of controlling inflation. This was Volcker's innovation on October 6, 1979, was to set the monetary aggregates as, instead of setting the price of money, set the quantity of money, and use the reserve base for controlling the quantity of money. Money market funds were seen as a substitute for, particularly for narrow money. You could write checks against the accounts up to 6 or something like that. I can't remember what the, well, I mean, the, I think it varied from fund to fund, but you could write checks every month. So I was involved in the early 80s in thinking about how these things should be regulated and whether they should have explicit reserve requirements on them from the perspective of monetary policy, not from the perspective of financial stability. That effort to put reserve requirements on money market funds obviously never came to anything, and in fact, by late 1982, the targeting of M1 as a aggregate for monetary policy was downgraded because of various deregulations. And innovations in the financial markets just made it a less useful guide to policy. That was my angle into the money market mm-hmm. funds in the early 80s.
And what was the Fed what did the Fed do in terms of reserve requirements? Were they going to Congress?
I don't remember specifically. Mm-hmm. So what I remember is having conversations with people in the money fund mm-hmm. industry who were not overjoyed at the idea of holding non-earning reserves at the Federal Reserve. Whether there was... So there must have been a public effort, a public discussion of this, mm-hmm. or they wouldn't have been in. But whether there was a actual proposal for a law, how mm-hmm. where it got to, I don't recall.
Okay. And if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the Fed sort of lost interest after the...
lost interest from a monetary policy perspective. Not sure about from a financial stability perspective, because weren't there some examples in the 80s, maybe in that high interest rate period, mm-hmm. in which money funds threatened to break the buck and... their parents came in and replenished them.
Right.
So there was kind of a, I guess my memory would be, there was kind of a low-level periodic mm-hmm. concern. I have no recall of specific proposals about what to do about this. And, of course, it was an SEC issue, not a Fed issue from that.
It would be a Fed issue to the extent that banks were sponsoring the money market funds.
That's right.
And if this helps jog your memory, in 1994, when the Fed raised interest rates, there were a lot of these instances of... I think the most famous one was the Bank of America or Bank America with the Pacific Fund. Does that help at all?
No, I mean, it just, you know, as you say it, it rings true as the sort of thing that happened periodically. But I don't have a specific memory of that. 1994 was a very rough period in financial markets. The Federal Reserve started to raise interest rates for the first time since 1991, I guess, or 1989, in terms of raising it. It had been held at 3% for a long time, and there was a very violent reaction in bond markets.
Right.
But I have no memory of that specific incident. But it sounds right.
Okay. And what were the Fed's concerns in terms of safety and soundness?
For the banks.
For the banks, or I thought you mentioned after 1982, you were still interested in the funds from a safety and soundness perspective.
Or from a stability.
Right.
I don't have a specific memory, but I think in my sort of sense is that this idea that every once in a while there would be a perturbation in the financial markets that would feed back on the money funds would require support. It was certainly something that was reported to the board. I have no recall whether the board expressed specific concern or had a specific proposal on these things.
And what about the effect of the money market funds on the traditional banking system?
So certainly through the 1970s into the early 80s, that was a problem, or that was seen as a problem because of Regulation Q. So
DIDMCA?
Depository Institution Deregulation,
Money Pair Control.
Whatever that thing.
Right.
Right.
1980,
but then it operated over a series of years, so it was sort of a gradual deregulatory thing on deposits. Before that, there was certainly not only money funds, but Treasury bills were seen as competitors for banks, and at some point in the early 70s, I think the Treasury raised the minimum on the Treasury bills. Is that right?
$10,000.
And so this was a continuing issue, not just for the Fed, but for the financial system and for others, in the sense of squeezing the banks, especially the SNLs, but the banks in addition, because of the controls on the payment of interest by banks.
And did IMCA resolve that? Or I've heard.
I think you can just call it DIDIC, because the MCA was the Monetary Control Act. Depository Institution Deregulation and Monetary Control Act.
Right. Okay.
So DIDIC, I think. Well, is what they call it.
All right. But did that resolve the problem?
Pretty much, because it resolved it in large measure. For the household sector, because remember the decontrol was on checking accounts was for household checking accounts, and it wasn't until this year that commercial banks were granted the authority, effective next year, to pay interest on demand deposits for businesses. The Federal Reserve had a long position that they long had a position that they should be, but they weren't. So it did resolve to a considerable extent the cyclicality of flows from household accounts when Reg Q hit. So it was helpful.
But the disintermediation with securitization continues on through the 90s.
The banking system becomes a smaller portion of the whole financial system, certainly through a good part of the 90s. That's correct.
And was that a matter of concern to the Fed?
It was certainly a phenomenon that was discussed and reported on.
Right.
Was it a matter of concern? I don't... I don't recall that it was a matter of concern, but I don't have specific recall of the discussions around that.
Okay. And in the middle of this period, 1990, the depository bank institutions, the banks and the
right.
SNLs,
right.
Are in bad shape.
That's correct.
And some of them may have even been insolvent, would you say? Or
well, clearly, many of them went out of business. So,
well, I'm,
yes.
I'm thinking more like the Citibanks and the Bank of America as the big institutions.
I don't know whether
right.
they were insolvent, but you're right. There was trouble,
right.
but was widespread trouble in the system when the commercial real estate market collapsed, right?
Right. And did the Fed's thinking about the financial system change at all because of that?
I think, if anything, and I'm reflecting my own thinking as mm-hmm. much as I am the Fed's thinking, the fact that the banks had suffered these problems. And so I'm approaching this. I'm a macroeconomist and a monetary policy
mm-hmm.
guy, not a supervisor.
Right.
Right. So from my perspective, as we went through that period, the fact that there were securitization markets for mortgages and consumer credit, and to some extent for small businesses that were guaranteed by a small SBA, was a helpful thing. I think you get at the spare tire thing somewhere in here.
Right,
so,
right.
So to me, Greenspan talked about the 50-mile-an-hour headwinds. And the 50-mile-an-hour headwinds were the banking system tightening up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those headwinds, in my mind, would have been 75 or 100 miles an hour if there hadn't been a non-banking aspect, a securitization aspect also out there. So I think you know, that might have been part of the thinking behind
mm-hmm.
saying that a system that had both a banking system, a strong banking system, and a strong non-banking system was probably presumably a more robust and resilient system, that credit flows could shift from one of those channels to the other channel if one of them became distressed.
Right. And this was also, in this period, a time of, I guess you could call, re-regulation. FIREA, FDICIA.
FDICIA,
yes. I use those acronyms too much. But one of the features of, or there were two features of FDICIA that I was interested in. One was the Section 13(3) exemption.
Yep. Yes.
And do you recall the discussions around that?
So some of what I'm going to tell you I recall, and some of what I infer. So
okay.
I infer that after the 87 stock market crash,
mm-hmm.
and then the Drexel was 90?
Yes,
90. Okay. There were a number of issues having to do with the settlement and clearing of trades and transactions in the immediate aftermath of the 87 crash and then the Drexel implosion bankruptcy. And I do recall, through the second half of the 80s and maybe into the 90s and into the 90s, having discussions with people in the legal division, suppose we needed to lend to a broker-dealer, or suppose we had a situation where the financial system started to freeze up because broker-dealer A wouldn't forward their funds to clearing court B, who could then forward their funds to broker-dealer C or bank
mm-hmm.
C, right? So you had a freeze-up, which you did have for a few hours after the 87 stock market crash.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also a problem. The Drexel thing is that the 87 stock market crash freeze-up is clear in my mind, partly because I think in Greenspan's book he talked about it, so it kind of it's been years, you know, three or four years since I read that, but Goldman or someone had refused to make to send money. It was all about New York and Chicago and all that sort of thing. And also, there was an issue with the Options Clearing Corp. And I think the Fed had to do something with First Chicago to allow it to support it. Was there something
in
there?
It barely opened on one of the days.
Yes. But didn't the Federal Reserve have to do something in its bank holding company regulation to allow support? Maybe this was a 23A exemption or something. I don't recall, but I recall a discussion like that. But I think the point is that there were several points in that thing in which, at least on the staff level and presumably on the board level as well, the discussion was, suppose this thing freezes up, is there a way for the Federal Reserve to supply liquidity into the system so that settlement, clearing and settlement can continue and the whole system doesn't freeze? And 13.3, as it was written, I guess in the 30s, whenever it was written,
right,
20s, I think someone told me, but anyhow, as it stood at that time, had a phrase in it about lending for types. You probably know the answer to this, but there was a phrase in it that had some that referenced
like
the rest
paper
of
paper and discounted commercial paper or something.
It was something about you couldn't discount. It tied 13.3 to the rest of 13, and in that tying, you weren't allowed to discount for the purchase and carrying of securities. There was something like that. So the thought was, every time we came up to one of these situations, we had discussions with the legal division and the policymakers. If we had to make a loan to an investment bank to prevent the system from freezing up, could we do it? And there are all sorts of plans for trying to pass through loans to commercial banks, et cetera, but there wasn't any way for the Federal Reserve to actually make the loan directly. And in a situation like the 87 stock market crash, the commercial banks themselves were trying to protect themselves, so they wouldn't have been willing to make that loan. So what happened in 91 was the Federal Reserve asked that phrase be deleted from 13.3 in order to make loans to investment banks possible in an emergency.
Okay, and was there any opposition to that politically?
Not that I'm aware of, right. Not that I can recall. Okay. So now what I was also trying to recall, having seen the questions, is who did I talk to about this? And I'm certain I had discussions with staff in the Senate Banking Committee and probably the House Banking Committee. For some reason, discussions with Senate Banking Committee are clearer. I also have a vague memory, which may or may not be correct, that in the markup and the Senate Banking Committee, part of this memory I had very clear, which is they called me up to the witness team and at the markup, and it was all about the discount window and the restrictions that were put on the use of the discount window there. But I kind of think this other thing came up in that discussion, but I'm not really sure.
The thing
we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
The 13.3 thing came up. But I can't really, I kind of think it did, but I'm not sure about that.
Yes,
and there'd be no transcript of a markup session, right?
I don't think so.
When the Fed was considering it, 13.3, so you could extend support to a broker-dealer.
At this time, in 1990.
In 1990.
Yeah, the change, right.
Was there also consideration of the issue of extending support to the holding company of a broker-dealer?
I don't recall. I don't remember.
I think that originally you could only use collateral that was good at the discount window.
Right.
Isn't that it? And so they think that was the part that was taken out.
Right, and there was something else in Section 13 which said, remember, this was probably written in a depression, that said you couldn't lend for the purchase or carrying of securities or something like that. So, and it was that part that made it impossible to lend to the broker-dealer.
We've heard and not confirmed that the securities industry was the one who proposed this, it sounds...
I don't remember.
Okay,
I'm sure they... I would infer that they didn't object.
But
I don't recall. Certainly the Federal Reserve didn't object and supported it. Wherever the original idea came from, the Federal Reserve was supportive.
Right. Okay. And in terms of this support, a lot of the times when they talk about threats to the financial system, they're talking about threats to the payment system. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't, I may be wrong, but this doesn't sound like the payments system in the normal sense of writing checks and things like that.
Right.
So
this was the payment system in terms of paying for securities and having those securities transactions go through, so that it's an important, a critical piece of the overall payment system.
Okay.
But you're right, it's not paying for goods and services, not you and me buying groceries. It's one pension fund buying treasury securities from an insurance company passing through the broker-dealer. And if that thing froze up, then the system would be in very bad shape.
Can you elaborate on that, the system?
Well, so I think that if broker-dealers weren't sure they were going to be paid because they didn't know whether the dealer on the other end would forward the cash from its customer, then no one would engage in any transactions.
Okay.
So there would be...
I guess what I'm trying to get towards is the implications for the economy as a whole. You might even think of it as, Main Street. What does Main Street care about something like that? How does it connect to them?
Well, I think if the financial markets weren't functioning, if the stock market shut down... If the Treasury securities market shut down, even if the options market shut down, which came closer than the others, I do think the flow of credit to Main Street would be severely disrupted. And remember, these are ultimately the pension funds holding Main Street's money, the insurance companies insuring Main Street's life and auto and house. Mm-hmm. The college endowments financing Main Street's kids, education. So I think I can't. Maybe this is my sort of central bank perspective, but I can't imagine an economy not. And in fact, we had an economy in which people were afraid to do financial transactions with each other. Would be an economy where households couldn't borrow. Businesses couldn't borrow, and that's almost precisely what happened in the fall of 08.
Right. Okay. Right. This goes into a question that I had further on, but I'll ask it now. The Fed has intervened in the capital markets several times. I can think of 1970 with the commercial paper, Penn Central, 1980, the Hunt Brothers. That's commodities futures,
right,
1982 with repo, and then 98.
82, I'm not sure. What's 82?
Repo was less publicized and less conventional. The Fed would loan out securities to the repo market because Dreyfus and then Lombard Wall failed, and there was a worry that
there was a securities lending program. Of course, the securities lending program was a continuing presence. I remember that there were issues with Dreyfus and Lombard Law, but I don't remember what our response to that was.
Okay. And there may have been more, but during the Drexel period, there was talk of the Fed or, you know, some sort of intervention, but it didn't occur. And I'm not sure if there are other instances that you can think of where it was discussed but right. not thought of. Right. But I'm wondering, were there criteria, or in retrospect, can you think of the differentiation?
So list them again. Penn Central,
the Hunt Brothers. Dreyfus.
Yeah, which I don't remember that.
Right.
But okay.
LTCM. Did I forget one?
Continental.
That's
a bank, right.
Yeah, so you're thinking about the non-bank.
Right.
So you're still on the non-bank thing. But, of course, Penn Central was about when I hit the Kansas City Fed. So I think here's a case. Let's be clear about what some of these interventions were.
Okay.
In the case of Penn Central, the intervention was, we will lend to banks, we will help banks if they need liquidity because businesses can no longer access the commercial paper market and they come to the banks after Penn Central failed and defaulted on its commercial paper. In point of fact, there was no borrowing. It wasn't used.
Right.
But it's not, so I would say, to me, it's not unusual or untoward to say that if a piece of the financial markets freezes up, collapses, it comes into the banking system, that if the banking system has trouble meeting that demand, and as a consequence businesses, households would have trouble getting credit, that the Federal Reserve agrees to supply liquidity, not capital, liquidity.
Right.
That's what central banks were created for. That's why the Fed was created in 1913. It was created an elastic currency to supply liquidity where it was necessary. So it seems to me the Penn Central thing was an attempt not to save Penn Central, but to prevent the spillover effects of Penn Central on businesses that weren't failing but might have their liquidity dry up. Is exactly why central banks were... why Congress created the central bank. On the Hunt brothers, and the criteria must have been, although I obviously wasn't here, there's a potential spillover from a drying up of liquidity on the economy that has nothing to do with saving a failing company, because Penn Central was going to fail in any case. And this was all about walling off the effects of Penn Central from the rest of the economy. In the case of the Hunt brothers, I think our involvement stemmed primarily from the credit controls that the Carter administration had put in place. So the Carter administration had, under the law, and actually heard Volcker on this, not on Hunt brothers per se, but on the credit thing at this... over the IMF weekend, or I didn't hear him. I was listening on the computer to this thing. But had the Carter administration had the authority to tell the Federal Reserve to control the quantity of credit in certain ways, and they exercised that authority. I think my inference would be as a way of trying to reduce the pain of reducing inflation. So in the spring of 1980, they gave these orders to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve and Volcker's ruminations on this were, maybe I should have resisted them more than I did, kind of thing, because it turned out to be disastrous in a number of respects, but the...
resisted the Carter administration?
Yeah,
not the Hunt brothers.
No.
Okay.
The Hunt brothers didn't come up in that conversation,
what
he was talking about. And I think part of the... So I hope I'm not conflating two things, but here, you asked me what I remembered. So I think in that... I mean, we we tried to stop people from overusing their credit cards and businesses from overborrowing some of the flows of credit from Europe and the Eurodollar market back to the U.S. and things like that. And it was a disaster because the public interpreted it as they don't want us to borrow. They started mailing in their credit cards and the economy sank like a tank. But I think part of that credit control thing was controls on the growth of bank lending, and particularly bank lending for certain kinds of purposes. I mean, I didn't go back and check this, but so this is what I remember. So in that, so at that time, then the partly because Volcker, probably mostly because Volcker broke the back of inflation, people could see that was happening. Interest rates got up to 20%. This speculative element in the silver market collapsed, and the Hunt brothers got left. Now they there was. So what do I remember that? I do remember that there was concern and people certainly keeping Chairman Volcker apprised of what was going on in the markets. Beish was threatened.
Right.
And then there was a... So I think the intervention was the bankers coming to Volcker and saying, we would like to lend some money to facilitate an orderly resolution of this, but they had to ask his permission under these credit controls. That's
okay. What I've read is that...
than what I remember.
Perhaps. That Volcker arranged a consortium to help, I guess, give an orderly wind down
right.
to the Hunt brothers, and it struck me as very similar to what happened with LTCM.
So the question is whether he arranged it or whether they came to him. They needed his permission because of these credit. What was the date?
I have no idea.
Okay, so I wondered whether it was in this credit control period. It was 1980, though?
It was 1980.
So it could have been in this credit control period. The story I remember from Volcker is he's in a motel room in Florida in his PJs, and these bankers are coming in asking him for permission to make these loans. Now, my guess, I don't know.
Okay. My interest in the Hunt brothers was not on the Hunt brothers so much as the similarity with
the Federal Reserve.
LTCM.
Right.
And I wanted to move to that. My sense from reading what you were saying was in your speeches was that. You did not agree with the people who said that this was creating, LTCM created moral hazard because, it tipped the Fed's hands. Was there anyone inside the Fed that disagreed with that?
So I guess I don't know if I thought it created zero moral hazard,
okay.
but I thought that the moral hazard was quite limited because there was no public money
right.
involved. I don't know. I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Recall that raised more concerns than
me. Ironically, there was Volcker wrote an op-ed in the New York Times afterwards saying this was not a good idea. So if you're right, and it's analogous to the Hunt brothers,
right.
I don't think it is because
right.
I think the impetus came from a different direction. There's irony there.
Okay. All right, and then going back to Fiducia, there was also a systemic risk exemption.
That's correct.
And I was wondering if you could comment on the Fed's thinking behind that.
So the Fed was supportive of both the more rule-based instructions to the FDIC not to to use the least cost method. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, took a little bit of comfort from the fact that there was a systemic risk exception in there. So I don't, I don't recall huge debates about this. Now, what is the case is that there were sporadic discussions between Fed staff and FDIC staff over the last half of the 90s about what did this mean, what, how would this be invoked if the exception were to be invoked, could the Fed help the FDIC in terms of lending, for example, if the FDIC needed funds to support a systemic risk exception. I don't recall the details, but there were discussions.
Was it seen as an important change, or was it seen as sort of a formalization of arrangements that had occurred before?
I saw it as an important change because it, and my perspective on this was the discount on a perspective. So I was in charge, the staff in charge of the operation of discount window. And as I noted, I was up at the witness table at the banking committee markup of Fiducia on the discount window side. And what is true and what I testified to at that time is we, and there was a guy from the FDIC there also who didn't say anything and let me dangle slowly, slowly in the wind, but we never made a loan that the FDIC didn't to a troubled bank. The FDIC didn't ask us to make, and we made it. And the FDIC made those requests when it felt that a disorderly wind down would be more costly than an orderly wind down. But I could see that there was very little discipline on that system. Mm-hmm. I kind of agreed, actually, with the FDIC that probably in most cases our lending had helped them get a higher price, preserve franchise value, etc. But they didn't have to prove it the way they probably should have had to prove it. So I didn't. I remember wondering what would happen in a crisis with this systemic risk exception, whether the hurdle for invoking the systemic risk exception was so high that it would be difficult to control a crisis situation. So I guess to some extent I was a little concerned that the Congress might have tied the hands of the authorities more than was wise, but in general, I think the Federal Reserve, I know some of my colleagues on the staff were very, very supportive of the prompt corrective action, very supportive of prompt corrective action and the more rule-based, disciplined approach to the FDIC.
Ask a quick question about prompt corrective action. Prompt corrective action is triggered by capital levels.
Right.
But capital is a lagging indicator.
It is.
So why were people so enamored of prompt corrective action based on that kind of a rule?
Well, I think they recognized the deficiencies, but it was better than nothing. So So it was better than not having any action. And at least I think, to the extent that institutions could see that their capital was shrinking and that they would be subject to prompt corrective action after their next published quarterly report, then they would take actions ahead of time to avoid that coming. So I think it wasn't perfect, and that was recognized. And from the discount window perspective, part of this was we were limited in the amount of loans we could make to critically undercapitalized and critically undercapitalized banks because the Congress saw us as facilitating the outflow of uninsured deposits and thereby raising the cost to the taxpayer of the ultimate resolution. But we wrestled from our discount window perspective with the point you just made, that sometimes a state regulator would come and say, this bank isn't undercapitalized. Look at the published numbers, and you knew damn well that it was about to go out of business. So you've raised an important point, but I still think it was, as formulated, it was better than not having.
And it depended on the public numbers, not on what the examiner might see in between quarterly statements or whatever?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
All right. And to clarify, in two specific examples, I'm thinking Continental Illinois and the Bank of New England. In both cases, the FDIC came to the Fed and asked for loans, or did the Fed act first?
So Continental Illinois, and what's the second one?
The Bank of New England.
Oh, I think in both. So I'm less familiar with Continental Illinois, but my impression from being a little bit on the fringes of that one in 1984, spring of 84, was that there was agreement among the regulators, including the Comptroller of Currency and the FDIC and the Fed, on making the loan to stabilize that thing and have an orderly, basically an orderly failure of Continental Illinois. I think what I do recall Chairman Volcker in that Continental Illinois situation did not want to protect the subordinated debt or the
uninsured creditors
of the holding company.
Yes.
So he was, I think, I mean, you'd have to talk to him, and so I shouldn't, for these purposes, shouldn't say what I think he was thinking, but my impression was that he was particularly upset about protecting the creditors of the bank holding company. That somehow that, and there were some sort of cross default clauses or something that made that important to do, or it was hard not to do. So I remember him being upset about that. I don't remember his views on protecting the bank, but I guess I would guess that he was all right with having an orderly wind down of the bank itself, the institution. I don't know who approached whom on that. That would have followed Penn Square, right? So So Penn Square generated all these loans. Continental Illinois ended up with some of them, and then the C first. I'm pointing up to the northwest part of the map for the purposes of the tape. Seattle had some of them, and I wasn't involved in the Penn Square situation. I guess that was a couple of years before that, wasn't it?
82,
right. But the Fed was involved in that and the knock-on effects there. In the case of Bank of New England, I was in a more senior position, and for sure that was the FDIC was quite supportive on board with that thing, and there was concern about, if I remember correctly, about Bank of New England even had some euro dollar liabilities, did it, and there was some question about whether to protect that, and so there I don't know where the impetus exactly came from in every case, but I don't have any recall that there was any conflict between the regulators on these things.
Okay. Moving to, I guess, a different topic, I was interested to read your thoughts about the so-called Greenspan put. And I was wondering if, in terms of the rest of the Fed, how other people... Let me back up a minute. Before these periods, there would be a run-up in asset prices, but very little inflation.
Right.
And how would the Fed sort of internally explain itself?
Like before 87 or before...
Or...
99 or 2000.
That you'd have a bubble, essentially. And I know the Fed's thoughts about pricking the bubble. I'm just interested in what how the Fed is trying to explain why asset prices increase and inflation does not.
I think so. Just to put the premise, make sure the premise is clear. Mm-hmm. The Fed's view, the Fed's perspective was on the macro economy mm-hmm. rather than on individual asset prices. So we were trying to keep inflation stable and unemployment low, so consistent with our legislative mandate. Now, I think within that, it's always possible to have swings in asset prices. Mm-hmm. You have waves of greed and fear. You've got misapprehensions, misestimates of what particular innovations mm-hmm. might mean, thinking of the high-tech boom. Often in these cases, there were staff analyses that suggested that these prices were out of line, mm-hmm. but we didn't see it as part of our mandate mm-hmm. to use a very blunt tool, the interest rate, to stabilize asset prices and destabilize the economy.
Right. There were other tools you could use, though, in terms of asking them to keep more
margin,
as a reserve.
Margin yeah. requirements. You mean margin requirements on stocks, for example?
Right. Well, we still... Okay. Margin requirements on stocks and in terms of the consolidated entity, you're dealing with some of the other regulators' capital requirements.
So on the margin requirements on stock, I think after the early 80s, the view at the Federal Reserve was that margin requirements on stock were an important safety and soundness instrument, protecting the broker-dealers and the banks, mm-hmm. But weren't really an instrument for affecting asset prices. And the great bulk of the literature, studies of the margin requirements, had generally found that they weren't effective at affecting prices. The theory certainly was they shouldn't be effective at affecting prices. Particularly as the 80s went on, there were so many ways of getting leverage in the stock market, in the futures market, in the options market, to control the leverage mm-hmm. on the cash market. Told you nothing about the total leverage in the market. So, but it was a safety and soundness thing. So, in effect, I think the Federal Reserve kind of passed that off to the SEC and the CFTC, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly, saying, you guys are in charge of making sure these markets are safe and sound.
Did they do that explicitly? Or
I think so. Okay. I think so.
Can you think about dates or events?
There was a study of margin requirements in the early to mid-80s. And the study came to the conclusion I just told you. The study published by the Federal Reserve, and I think sent to the Congress. So maybe this was in the early 80s. I participated as a staff member in an oversight position. I didn't write the study, but a kind of oversight position on some of that. And it's sort of been after my involvement in that particular thing ended, I believe that the Federal Reserve wrote a letter to the SEC, maybe CFTC, or there was some kind of agreement there about that. And of course, the initial mm-hmm. margins have been the same since 1975.
Right.
And the great thing about them is they're 50-50, so you have to remember which is which, right?
Right.
So the but I don't recall when, but I think there was some official action, in effect delegating, it's probably not the right legal word,
right,
but in effect delegating to the SEC and the CFTC oversight of these things in some cooperative kind of way. So I think as the stock market ran up in 87, I don't remember, the run-up in the stock market in 87 was pretty sudden and sharp, as I remember. And Alan Greenspan, to his credit, came into office in August of 87 and said, there's a problem here. And he was concerned about the potential for a sudden collapse in stock prices. And he had the staff running around doing what-if things. My memory is that when the crash actually came, we never actually took out the pieces of paper we produced about what to do if the crash mm-hmm. came. But anyhow, but I think the exercise was probably useful. But I don't recall in that case question margins. Now it came up in the 90s in the tech boom, and there is it even came up in the FOMC, and there's some dialogue in the FOMC in which, as the transcript reads, it has Greenspan saying we could do this and it would have an effect, but we shouldn't, or something like that. But it didn't sound like Greenspan to me. It sounded like a mistake. There was a knot missing somewhere in there. It just didn't sound right. But people have thrown that back at him about why did you raise margin requirements. Certainly the discussions around that time were all the sort that I just, we could try it, probably wouldn't have any effect, and if it didn't have any effect, this here's my own thinking, then people would expect you to start raising interest rates. Because if you say there's a problem here and you try to hit it and you don't, doesn't work, then you're going to have to try, you know, what's the stick in the closet. And getting in that situation, if raising interest rates wasn't also consistent with the macro economy and inflation, right, would have put the Fed in a very difficult position.
You mean there would be a credibility issue if it didn't follow?
Well, if you thought this was, I guess I was a little worried that you thought this was severe enough, that you're going to take this instrument out that you hadn't used in 20 years, mm-hmm. and you had been saying probably wouldn't be effective, and then use it, then you must think it's a pretty severe problem with macroeconomic implications, and people would expect you to do more.
And then the expectation would cause you to do more? Because,
well, I think it would put the Fed in a difficult position.
Okay.
That was my worry. I don't remember other people expressing that, but that was one of my concerns. It was, I likened it somewhat to foreign exchange intervention, which most economists think sterilized foreign exchange intervention, which doesn't affect the monetary base, has no, in effect, no lasting effect on foreign exchange rates. If it has an effect, it's only because people expect it to be followed by something else. And I was kind of thinking in those, in
right,
those terms. So there, that discussion occurred, but it never, I don't, and there was a lot of public discussion too. Why don't you guys do something with margin requirements? Not a lot, but some. It was mm-hmm. certainly out there. But I don't, in my memory, there wasn't a lot of people inside the institutions supporting the use of margin requirements in the late 90s.
Okay, and you mentioned leverage earlier. And with the shadow banking system and derivatives, there were all sorts of new ways that people could take on leverage.
Right.
Was that a concern in the Fed?
So you mean particularly in the 90s and 2000s?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, moving more towards,
right,
that. I don't remember, actually, whether there was a lot of discussion of the embedded leverage in the derivatives.
Uh-huh. But just in general, I mean, securities firms don't have to keep as much capital, et cetera.
I don't recall concerns, discussions of securities firms. So I think we continue to track the banks. We probably took more comfort than we should have with 2020 hindsight from the fact that the banks were very well capitalized, were very profitable. I don't remember discussions of leverage in the investment banks, which were huge.
Right. I think this is moving towards the spare tire idea. Greenspan gives these speeches saying the capital markets and the depository banks provide a spare tire for each other.
Right.
And then the Fed supports the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act,
yes,
which would seem to put both sectors within the same firm. And that puzzled me. Do you see the source of my puzzlement?
To some extent, though I do think the just because you have an investment bank and a commercial bank in the same holding company doesn't mean the securities markets will collapse at the same time the banking system collapses.
Mm-hmm.
So my impression was that one of the goals of GLB, or one of the premises maybe, mm-hmm, of GLB was protect the banking system. So there was a lot of the effort was to have the Fed light, so you didn't need a lot of oversight over the securities part of the operation that the SEC wasn't, mm-hmm, already doing. We should rely on the SEC. If you protected the core, the banks were still seen as the core of the system,
mm-hmm,
and if you protected the core, then you might still have the spare tire. You might be all right.
Okay.
So I don't. I understand your point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the banks, let's say it was a late 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm, issue, and the banks were impaired because of commercial real estate lending, would they be able to support the securities side of their operation? But, you know, there were so many independent investment banks before the crisis. Seven or whatever, big, mm-hmm, seven or whatever it was, you know, whatever.
It's that rapidly dwindling.
It's rapid, yeah. No, but we're
right,
talking about 1990s. It was
right.
Even more,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I think if a commercial bank, uh-huh, affiliate, if a commercial bank had been in trouble and that had impaired the ability of its securities affiliate to make markets, there was lots and lots of other people who would step in to make the markets. And my impression is, and you guys have studied this harder than I have, is that the story of the crisis isn't that the commercial banks infected, mm-hmm, the securities markets. To some extent, it was the securities markets infecting the banks through the conduits and sieves that came back,
right,
on their banking books. So to that extent, but I'm not sure that was. So I guess I asked you guys as lawyers. I don't.
Well, I'm not a lawyer.
You're not a lawyer.
No, we have one lawyer in the room, I think.
So my question would be: did GLB enable the conduits and the sieves, or could they have, mm-hmm, been constructed?
Can I frame, yeah, that question?
Yeah.
As of 2008, Herring and Carmassi, the eight largest complex financial institutions had 1,000 or more affiliates of different kinds. Citigroup, right, had 2,500.
Right, right.
So my question is, initially, I assume that this grew over that period, but still there were significant, it was significant complexity of institutions,
yeah,
even in 99.
Yeah.
It strikes me that it had to be more than just banks and broker-dealers.
Right.
That it had to be sort of a combination of other kinds of activities. Now, of course, we discover AIG Financial Products, and you can go down the list.
Right.
So I'm curious, who thought about FedLight and what they thought about that set of issues, sort of the potential threat to the bank or to the holding company of who knew what in all of these complex entities.
So I think I wasn't involved in the negotiations that led to FedLight to the GLB, so I can't speak with authority about who was thinking what in that time. I guess my impression is that it was kind of a bargain, a compromise of some, and I don't know if bargain isn't the right word, but the package that was put together was banks can expand into these other areas. Those areas, I think, were pretty much regulated in one way by someone or other, sometimes foreigners.
Or states.
And the Federal Reserve had oversight, but it was supposed to rely on those other regulators, right? So your question is, did the Fed worry about FedLight? There was some concerns about that I heard from time to time. So I was not in the supervisory area, but obviously you hear these things and you're in some of these conversations as a member of the board. So there was, you know, some concern about whether there was sufficient oversight over some of these institutions, but I don't remember a robust discussion of should we go to Congress and ask them to do something about FedLight. I don't, and I think in the end, to me, a weakness occurred in the SEC's oversight of the investment banks, and the implementation of what they saw as Basel II, and allowing, that's where a lot of the leverage and the maturity mismatch was. That's not to say that commercial banks didn't get in trouble here. Obviously they did, so I'm not saying they wouldn't. But somehow that piece didn't work, and what were the initials of the
CSE,
Consolidated Supervision
Supervised Entity.
Right, CSE. So they needed that in order to expand into Europe. And I guess my impression, certainly through the crisis, was that CSE was SEC light. And so the extent that the Federal Reserve was relying on the SEC to keep the other pieces of the system going, that wasn't working. But most of those investment banks weren't affiliated. None of them were really affiliated with commercial banks, right?
Well, let me sketch an issue. For example, there were a number of banks that might have thought they were pulling back from the subprime market, that had warehouse lines of credit to originators that were not broker-dealers, but were sort of large, virtually unregulated, or call them state-regulated entities, large mortgage companies, whatever, that created in the end significant financial exposure to the bank. And the critical issue, at least as I'm trying to think it through, is the difficulty under FedLight of being able to figure out those linkages and the essence of systemic risk and the concatenation of a shock would seem to be linkages.
I agree. I mean, I think that particularly the state regulation of mortgage originators was not robust, to say the least. And a lot of the originated, a number of the originated mortgages flowed at least through the banks. Now, sometimes, often they flowed through the banks and out the other end. But also true that when the music stopped, there was a lot of the stuff in some of the banks. And the S&Ls, Countrywide is the obvious example. So it was a problem, yeah.
But you're saying basically people weren't thinking of it at that point from, I mean, I'm thinking again of systemic risk and the essential task of policing linkages. And my question is, was that to some significant extent given up in FedLife in the sense that there was no one body that was going to be in a position to check the linkages? And did people think about that?
Yeah, so I don't actually, on the last part, I don't know, because I wasn't really involved in the supervision. Mm-hmm. So I'm relating to you kind of vague thoughts and sort of lunchtime conversation kinds of things, that there was at least an acknowledgement that our authority was pretty limited and stuff could be going on outside the banks that was hard to police. I think it's also the case that we didn't fully appreciate some of the complexities of these linkages and the implications of the linkages and the inner linkages. So I think it's not, so I would in some sense go beyond, if I think about the systemic risk here, go even beyond what you're saying. So there was the risk to individual institutions of getting stuck with lousy stuff on their books that was originated and held or was warehoused and got stuck. But then there were some of the other linkages. A number of institutions thought they had insured against some of this stuff with the monolines, with AIGFP, and I don't think we appreciated. I gave too many speeches, which some of which you've read. I'm sorry that said we think risk is diversified. We think it's being widely held. We kind of think that the people who have it, it's probably being distributed to people who understand it better than when it was all packaged and you couldn't diversify it. And I think in the end, it wasn't nearly as diversified. I think I've said that and with a 2020 hindsight, as we thought it was. And it came to rest on a few critical nodes in the system in ways that other elements of the system didn't appreciate how interdependent they were. And part of policing systemic risk, and there's a very burgeoning industry in this, will be identifying those nodes and those interlinkages.
If I can ask one more question.
No, you keep going.
Okay. I don't want to invoke Secretary Rumsfeld, but the difference between an unknown and a known unknown.
Yeah, yeah.
What feedback mechanisms exist within the Fed as an organization to systematically understand what the Fed doesn't know that the Fed might need to know?
No, it's a very good question. The unknown unknowns are hard by definition. And there's a certain amount of Knightian uncertainty where you'll never be able to really get a grasp on what the probabilities are in any system. But I think you're right, a systemic risk regulator needs to keep asking that question. To some extent, Ben Bernanke did. So much to Ben's credit, in my mind, he came in 2006 and he said, what am I kind of weakest in? I didn't hear him say these exact words, but I could infer from his actions. I'm an expert in monetary policy and macroeconomics, but I don't know very much about bank supervision and systemic risk, etc. And he put together a staff group, or he created a staff group to try and monitor systemic risk
and report to the board once or twice a year on what they were seeing. So I don't, you're going to ask me what was in those reports, and I don't remember, to tell the truth. I think they were, I don't know, I don't remember all the stuff was in there. But I think he recognized that we needed to ask that question. It's very, very hard. I mean, I've given it some thought ex post. Some people say you just gather a lot of information, and somewhere in that information there's going to be the... But I just think you could get overwhelmed by the amount of information.
Do you recall any actions taken as a result of that information?
No. I mean, there were discussions of potential systemic risk, but as I say, I don't recall the things identified. I certainly didn't bring any of my files, so I couldn't check... but there were occasional board discussions of potential systemic things.
Were they friendly? Were they contentious?
Well, they were friendly. No, all the board discussions are friendly.
That's for the record.
Yeah. No, it's probably...
Well, it's pretty much true, actually. I mean, people have disagreements, but I've never seen anybody get... Rarely seen anybody get nasty. I'm telling the truth here. Rarely seen anybody get nasty.
In those reports, did anybody bring up subprime lending? And was this,
I don't remember.
Do you have a whole committee designated to look after systemic problems? And
I don't remember.
Or is it the shadow banking?
But we understand that a gentleman named Sabeth Siddiq from the supervision side made a presentation to the board and then later to the Federal Reserve presidents in 2005. With respect to exposure to non-traditional mortgage products.
The non-traditional mortgage products is different. I was differentiating that from the subprime.
At interest only and option arms.
And there was certainly, that was certainly identified, and there was action taken. Now, you could easily, in terms of guidance on non-traditional mortgages, so that was certainly one of the things, and commercial real estate too, right? So there was action taken on commercial real estate exposure, so that must have been among the things identified. I think the question is whether it was tough enough, timely enough, etc. And I think a legitimate issue for the commission is these things that run through committees, like the FFIEC at that time. There's an inherent sluggishness to that process, and the tendency for the lowest common denominator to have more influence, because people try to get consensus in that process.
What do you mean by lowest common denominator?
I mean the Office of Thrift Supervision. I'm going to regret that, aren't I? But I think in
I was thinking more in the terms of the attitude or...
Well, I do. I think in this case, what I mean is that they were very conscious of the... I'm not sure about the non-traditional mortgages, but I'm pretty sure on the commercial real estate side, that they were very conscious of the smaller thrifts, smaller banks. And I testified next to John Rich on more than one occasion in which he was talking about the burden, the regulatory burden on smaller institutions. And there was my impression is, I never sat in on an FFIEC meeting, but my impression is that there was resistance to putting out tough stuff, tough regulations, particularly on commercial real estate. I'm less certain about the ALTA and the non-conventional.
We discussed with the OCC about those meetings, and they said it was, you know, you didn't know it was systemic until it became systemic.
I think that's
the way they identified it.
Well, I don't think that's. So the guidance wouldn't have gone out. I don't know how you define systemic in some sense. But if the supervisors themselves hadn't recognized that there was something going on here that was a threat either to individual institutions or the system, they wouldn't have put out the guidance if they didn't think there was something wrong happening, whether it's systemic or not. So I can see you could argue that we knew there was irresponsible, or we suspected there was irresponsible lending going on in the non-traditional mortgages, as Sabeth pointed out, and we took action. We didn't know that that would bring down the whole financial system. That's an argument. If I can follow up
yeah. on that, I can see, you know, post-2000, post.com, that you can look at things and say, oh, the risk was dispersed. And then over time, the risk becomes concentrated, and it sounds like the Fed missed that. And I was wondering if you had an idea, first of all, you know, comment on whether you would agree with that opinion, but then why would that be? Would that be a defect in the regulatory structure, or would that be, you know, a defect in, I guess, the regulators, or, you know...
By concentrated, you mean back to this idea of the nodes and the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure it's in the regulatory structure. There's mm-hmm. nothing in the structure, even this dispersed structure,
right.
that means that an institution couldn't say, are we sure there's no problem here, that sort of thing. I guess it just, you know, wasn't on the radar, obviously. I think there were, I mean, part of this is the stuff that came back on the commercial bank balance sheet. I think there was, my understanding is there were discussions of that, so we kind of moved from the all-A thing, but there were discussions of that and questions about whether stuff that was technically in the bankruptcy remote entity would come back on the balance sheet and what the examiner should do about that, at least in the examination function.
Right.
I don't think it ever got to the board, but lots of people missed that, I think.
Yeah. Well, Walter Wriston said it in 1981, right? If my name's on the door, I'm going to back it up.
Right.
I'm interested in the flow of information going back to the Fed. Mm-hmm. First of all, the question, because you've served in both roles in a senior way, staff and Board of Governors, mm-hmm. the extent to which you are comfortable with the way information flows, for example, from somebody on the supervision side to get to people who may have a larger view.
Well, I think there was, I think Bernanke made an effort through, first of all, he had regular meetings with the supervision staff, and secondly, there was this other group, I can't remember the name of it, that he put together to try mm-hmm. and spot oncoming trends to increase that flow of information. So it's not, as in any organization, it's never perfect. But I do think that efforts were being made to help that unclog the arteries, or to help the flow of information along, particularly efforts by Chairman Bernanke in that regard.
Would you be interested in taking a break?
I'm okay.
Okay.
Unless you're interested in taking a break, if that's what that meant.
No, it doesn't.
Thank you, Dave.
To go one step farther. Somebody commented to us that if it were being invented now, one would not invent the structure of the regional Federal Reserve banks and the board. And I'm curious about the flow of information.
I don't think that's a problem. So I don't think that part. My impression is that the flow of information on the supervisory side.
Okay.
From the regional banks to the board's Division of Supervision and Regulation is a pretty good flow. I thought you were raising the issue from there to the board members.
That it would be the next step.
You're right. I don't. There are tensions from time to time between the supervisory staff and the, or disagreements, as you would hope it would be, between people looking at situations between the center and the periphery, but I don't have the impression that the periphery was withholding information from the center.
if I can add, going back to your marvelous historical discussion, if we go back to October 6, 1979, Bernard Scholl, other people have written that this was, forget about causation, a precipitating event in the savings and loan debacle, because suddenly they went from the 363 business up to very high rates, and first they couldn't meet it, and then there was deregulation. They could meet it, but you can't take in deposits at 16 and make mortgages at 6 and make a business out of it for very long. The argument that Mr. Scholl makes is that the savings and loans were not represented in the Federal Reserve banks, that it was commercial banks. They had variable rate lending, so when interest rates jumped, and presumably the Open Market Committee would discuss the impact on the banking system, banks could simply reset on both sides of their balance sheet.
Yeah.
I'm curious, from your historical perspective, the extent to which that story is illustrative of anything.
I don't buy the story.
Okay.
I think that the SNLs were doomed
that
by the fact that their deposits were much shorter than their assets. It's true that their assets, which were 30-year mortgages for the most part, I mean, there was very little variable rate lending back in those days. It was just getting started, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. And banks also had maturity mismatches, but you're right, they were much less than the SNLs. But the SNL system was already in deep trouble before October 6, 1979, and was doomed. The fact that there was, before October 6, 1979, there was all kinds of fiddling with this Reg Q stuff. So there were special, First Pennsylvania and that guy Bunting or whatever his name was, I don't remember. There were all sorts of little tricks that banks and others had of getting around this, and things were authorized temporarily. I mean, as inflation rose in the 70s, so did nominal interest rates. They just didn't rise enough to stop the inflation. And I think if Paul Volcker hadn't had stopped the inflation, it would have been much worse, and the SNLs would not have been well off. And having SNLs represented on the boards of Federal Reserve banks wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever.
Interesting.
I just don't agree with that.
Okay.
And what would he have done? He would have not have, I think most economists, maybe with this one exception, think that what Paul Volcker did October 6, 79, and after, set the stage for two decades of strong growth in the U.S.
I don't think Mr. Scholl is objecting to that. I didn't mean to cut you off.
But it sounds like he didn't want it to happen quite the way it did.
His comment, I think, was more, it's almost a political science comment, that the Fed was getting input from its stakeholders and not enough input from those that, in fact, were going to be seriously adversely affected. It wasn't a comment at all on the need to squeeze out the...
I wasn't in that FOMC meeting. I didn't start attending for another year or two. But I was in the preparations for it, and I don't have the impression, at least at the staff level in the preparations, that the bank's views played any role whatsoever in that. This was about inflation and about Jimmy Carter hiring Paul Volcker to do something about inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And I don't think it didn't represent the commercial banks. The commercial banks got slammed to a certain extent also, as we were talking before about problems in the early 80s. And in the commercial bank, I guess it mm-hmm. didn't come up, but in the commercial banking system, Latin American loans and whatnot. So I don't buy it.
Okay, thank you. I have some questions on the supervisory side, if that's all right.
Okay.
The Fed around 2004 began to organize cross-cutting units. For example, large complex institutions, regional small banks, and then teams of experts, derivatives, mortgage market securitization. And one of the reasons for that was that it seemed relatively easy for a supervisor to go into a small bank and say, here's what we think you ought to do. But when you're going into the head of a large, complex financial institution, the conversation's a lot more difficult. Yep. I'm curious your perception, particularly through September of 2009, just over these years, how well that worked and what else you would recommend building in to improve the conversation with the head of a large, complex financial institution.
So my impression, and remember I wasn't involved in supervision,
right,
but my impression is that that was helpful by bringing expertise to bear on LCFIs from across the system and all these reserve banks out there, and there was some expertise here and other there, and you could bring it all to bear that the at least in theory, the analysis of the situation should be better, and I can't. It must have been somewhat better. I think you really almost identified two separate issues. One issue is identifying the problem, and the other one is curing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the identifying the problem, as I talked to the supervisors after the problems popped up, in many cases, they didn't have it exactly right, but they kind of suspected something was wrong. And you know, the problem identification issue is still an issue, but also an issue, and I think almost an issue you could separate would be, having identified the problem, how do you get the attention of the CEO?
Particularly when he's making a lot of money. Or yeah, when the institution is making a lot of money.
That's right. So when the institution is making a lot of money and you go to them and you say, I think there's a weakness here in your risk management that's a little hard, and he can say, but we're doing great. I think it's hard. But I also think that the Federal Reserve needed to escalate those conversations. And I think a junior examiner, even the senior supervisor in charge, isn't going to have as much weight in the board of directors as the head of supervision at the board or in the Reserve Bank or the president of the Reserve Bank or a governor of the board. I think one of the lessons, my impression from talking to supervisors, was one of the lessons learned was the need to escalate up the Federal Reserve system in order to have more forceful, impactful, if that's a word, discussions with the senior executives. Those are still going to be difficult discussions in good times. There's no question about it. It's hard to tell somebody whose institution's making lots of money and has been for several years, whose stock is highly valued, that you've got a weakness here. But it's sort of what we're paid to do. Sorry, it's still we, despite the fact it's been 2 months out of the
break. Right. Okay.
And the Federal Reserve and the examiners are paid to do. And I think the Federal Reserve recognizes that it needs to do a better job of that. Let's go back to the first point, recognizing and identifying the risks. There, the Federal Reserve has taken a substantial number of steps, particularly in the wake of the stress test. The stress test was, as I understand it, unique in the sense of bringing economists and their ability to look at the whole system and some of their statistical modeling techniques to look at the system into the future, in particular, to bear on the supervisory, the supervision of these banks, and to design stress scenarios, to run them in a way that is consistent across banks and not just rely on the bank's own models and modeling. The stress test, SCAP, I guess is the official name, was new from that in that regard, at least since the supervisor told me that. And the Federal Reserve has incorporated the lessons of SCAP in its supervision of large, complex financial institutions, systemically important financial institutions. It's much more multidisciplinary, much more forward-looking.
Can we talk for a minute about that? I have a concern, and I studied risk management. I grappled with Alan Greenspan's statement that what disturbed him most was a large number of institutions that failed to protect their own interests and those of their owners. And I thought for a man of his political persuasion to say that, one had to really grapple and understand. And so I've looked at about 9 different financial institutions and their governance and risk management. And there are some at the top that really got it. I worry about my inability or anybody's inability to communicate to the ones that didn't quite get it. It's almost like quantum levels, and there are a number of those levels. How equipped is a supervisor, this goes to the flow of information again, to deal with an institution that doesn't, that thinks they know, that's the worst part,
right,
and doesn't have a good picture of
their... The Federal Reserve and the other supervisors have taken steps to address that issue, and part of it is the horizontal review of risk management. So you're absolutely correct. Some institutions had risk management that worked. The CEOs and the boards paid a lot of attention. The risk managers were rewarded. They were encouraged to think outside the box, so to speak, and about stress scenarios. The tests were taken seriously. The management information systems were up to the task of stressing the whole institution. Other institutions, as you say, weren't there. They didn't have the management information systems. They didn't have the status of the risk managers wasn't sufficient. By running these horizontal reviews, which we did about 2 years ago, I think, we're able to bring to the ones that didn't have the highest level, at least we're able to say to them, you're competitors and you need to you have to bring up your risk management levels. You just don't have any choice in that. We're your supervisors. You can't continue to go like that. And here are some principles that you need to adhere to in terms of the governance of risk management, the practice and governance of risk management. So, and the management information systems defeat it. So I think the supervisors can do something in that regard. The government shouldn't be telling XYZ National Bank exactly how to design its risk systems. That's its thing, but we can demand that they be up to a minimum standard to protect the system.
What happens if a critical variable in risk management is the culture of the institution? And what we've been finding is it's relatively easy for a supervisor to go to an institution and say you violated the Bank Secrecy Act in the following 3 ways, or compliance review, and you haven't made this and this. And then it's much harder to get into squishy areas like culture, which may actually be the determining variable for effective risk management.
I think that's hard. I agree. I don't think it's impossible, because I think over time, probably flunk sociology here, but over time a culture is built up of specific actions and structures and governance structures. So if you insisted to the XYZ National Bank that didn't have a good risk management culture, you've got to do the following things. You've got to have your risk manager at the board meetings. He's got to report every quarter or every month or something. You have to have weekly meetings at which he or she is included. The risk manager has to have a certain compensation scheme that makes her the equal of other, you know, highly paid. I think if you end up doing all those specific things, even if the culture is somewhat resistant, you're going to accomplish an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And over time, the culture might even change, especially as you involve the board in this, because the board of directors must be at least somewhat concerned in these instances. If the supervisor goes to the board of directors and says, we think you're not doing this right, they're vulnerable. I mean, they have a certain responsibility, I think.
Let me, I got to give you a I've looked at some reviews from the Fed of risk management at a prominent, large, complex financial institution.
Right.
And in 2006, they got a really good rating. Mm-hmm. And in 2007, as they started to ship water, the rating went down. And in 2008, the rating was really bad.
Yeah.
How do we struggle with this lag?
Well, I think the horizontal reviews should help. So if there were horizontal reviews in 2006, the supervisor at least mm-hmm. should have a benchmark, a high water mark, mm-hmm. benchmark, whatever the right metaphor is, for, David, you know, you've got to...
I'm out of tapes.
I'm talking too much. So
we'll give you ours.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to reach certain standards. Here's what your competitors are doing. You've got to reach these standards. So not judging them against... I think too often in life we judge things by whether they're better or worse than they were a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And not by whether they meet the necessary standard.
And I'm actually not worried for the next 10 years.
Right. I think the issue is years 11 through 20, if everything goes well in the next 10. But I think we're trying both with the FSOC, with emphasis on systemically important institutions. I think we're trying to build, we the government are trying to build cultures within our own institutions that won't settle for less than adequate risk management, especially from systemically important institutions.
Right. I have two more questions. Is that right, Mike?
Okay.
One of them, is Citigroup different in terms of as a supervisory, an object of supervision, the subject of supervision?
I think different in what way?
At least some people seem to, I mean, first of all, we've backed them up from the time of the Great Depression and Giannini. Oh, no, that was Bank of America.
That was Bank of America.
But, I mean, we backed them up for decades,
1970s. From the time of Wolf, Aristonov, yeah, go ahead.
petrodollars, right? I mean, sovereign lending. They're larger, they're more complex.
Yeah. I think, and they grew by accreting, though JPM did the same thing.
Yeah, the others have done that too.
JPM put, you know, manufacturers and chemical and Bank One and JP Morgan all together, and they managed to do that right.
And what, that's your point.
Yeah.
They said we're having it on one information platform.
Right. I think Citi is obviously a very complicated organization. It obviously didn't do a very good job of managing risk. I don't know, you know, is it different? It was certainly wasn't in those top few, right? And I think their management information system never really integrated across all those entities that it acquired over time. You know, with 2020 hindsight, the Federal Reserve or somebody with control of the currency, somebody should have been on them more to spend the extra bucks to get the management information systems in better shape. But, yeah.
Mike's got more questions, but I got one last one. What's left of Walter Badgett?
I think everything's left of Walter Badgett. So I think that...
For my purposes and for the record, could you explain what that means?
So Walter Badgett was the editor of The Economist magazine in the late 1900s. Do you know exactly when?
It was
1800s, right. Late 19th century, I'm sorry.
1847,
right,
I think.
Right, okay. 1847?
Mid-1800s.
Okay, mid-1800s, I'm sorry. Late 19th century. So, and... among other things, I guess he wrote a lot about the English Constitution. But what we're talking about is he had an approach for central banks in a liquidity crisis, and he said you should lend freely at a penalty rate to solvent institutions against good collateral. Those are the basic precepts.
And, by the way, close down the other ones.
Yeah. I guess, right.
He didn't quite say that, but that was...
But certainly, that was the implication by saying the good institutions. So I think everything's left of Walter Badgett. I think the Federal Reserve honored the precepts of Walter Badgett with one or two exceptions that now sit in maiden lanes. So I think we... the ring fencing of Citi and Bank of America, you might put it. So where we dealt with individual institutions that were troubled, I think. But I think in terms of, if I think about our lending in the commercial paper market, the innovative lending on TALF, securitization markets, I guess we had a program, money market funds. No one ever borrowed from it, but even the broker dealer stuff, the penalties got small. But they were against good collateral to solvent institutions, with those exceptions. And the fact that all these facilities were closed without a loss to the taxpayer suggests that. And to me, what we did was, we took the Badgett precepts for commercial banks and applied them to his shadow banking system. Mm-hmm. When it's, I don't mean that literally, but applied them outside the commercial banking system when its implosion, when runs in those institutions threaten the financial stability and the economic stability of the country. So I think everything remains.
Here's what I'm worried about. It's not the shareholders. It's the debt holders. Mm-hmm. And the removing of debt holder discipline.
But that's implicit in Badgett for solvent institutions.
For solvent institutions. So we infused a whole bunch of capital into institutions that otherwise wouldn't be solvent, and thereby protected debt holders. And my question is, how we deal with that and what's...
Right, so I think, so you're not really talking about the Fed's liquidity facilities.
No.
You're talking about the TARP.
Yeah.
I see, the TARP. So I was defending the Fed's liquidity
facilities. Oh, I'm not attacking anyone. I'm trying to understand.
But the TARP and the TLGP.
Okay.
I think, I think we've approached... we'll see in the next crisis. I think Dodd-Frank helps to deal with the issue you're worried about by creating a resolution authority. Mm-hmm. And by forbidding the Federal Reserve from making loans itself to individual troubled institutions, right? In the at least under 13.3, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. So the Congress has attempted to deal with the moral hazard created by making it tougher for the regulators to engage in the same behavior, and by creating an alternative that will, at the very least, extend losses up the capital structure into subordinated debt holders and other senior debt holders. So I think to that extent there's been an attempt to deal with this. And the other side of it, of course, is by the regulators demanding much higher capital. They've made the odds on failure much lower.
I'm sort of puzzled by your mention of a penalty rate, because with this crisis and earlier crises, the Fed's response has been to drop rates fairly low.
The Fed funds rate.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm thinking of a penalty to the market rate. When I say penalty rate,
when
I borrow
a
collateral,
okay.
I get it. And even there, I thought you were going to argue that we lowered that penalty in an attempt to encourage banks to borrow when there was liquidity. So we did lower that penalty, but we didn't eliminate it. And if you think about something like TAL, the penalty was pretty substantial.
I'd like to ask you a question about Lehman Brothers, because that in particular has to do with. Is that okay, Michael?
I had a couple of questions. One was that, and so I'll do them quickly. One was
I'll try
that
to answer more briefly.
Well, you know, I'd like you to answer as completely as you can. The crisis could be seen as a run on the shadow banking system.
Definitely.
And
an aspect of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, in terms of the capital markets, and even going back so far as the money market funds in the 80s, was there ever a concern about a run occurring in the capital markets?
Well, so the run was on these structures that held, like, asset-backed market.
Right. Arguably, you could say that, like, the money market funds have a maturity mismatch.
Yes.
And so, therefore, if people think that they're going to break the buck, they could run no deposit insurance. So I was wondering if ever that sort of concern came up within the Fed.
So I think we can go back. The answer is yes, but I don't think we, to some extent, but we didn't see the vulnerability of secured lending. So go back to Drexel.
Mm-hmm.
The lesson from Drexel was unsecured lending can leave like that. And the rules that the SEC promulgated after Drexel had on liquidity rules for broker-dealers had all to do with unsecured lending and how much liquidity you needed. And I certainly didn't see the vulnerability of secured lending. The money market funds and the tri-party RP market, for example, those guys didn't want the collateral. They're really, it's secured lending, but it's really about the counterparty. And it wasn't until Bear Stearns and the general problems that rose. And Bear Stearns couldn't even borrow against agencies and treasuries at the end, that I think, at least I didn't realize how vulnerable that secured lending market would be.
And you didn't think it was vulnerable because the securities
because there was security and
they wouldn't lose value.
Well,
at least
I think
not
part of what happened in the tri-party market was that the collateral became much wider. There was much more collateral.
Right.
It was less liquid. And there was some wrong-way risk there. So you had unlike treasuries and agencies, which are likely to rise in value in a panic, you started having tri-party against other types of corporate debt securitizations, all that sort of things, that actually prices fall in a panic. Mm-hmm. And so I think the broadening of that market made it vulnerable to the run. So I agree. Right. I agree with you that runs, and I think Gary Gorton has that. It's the whole thing.
Yes.
I think he's exaggerating to an extent, but it was a major piece of the crisis, and certainly the post-Lehman crisis. To get back to his point, when that money market fund, prime reserve fund, broke the buck, there was a huge run on the commercial paper market. I mean, it was right. Terrible.
And the other question I had is earlier. I wanted to follow up on what you said.
And I don't think, by the way, I take this opportunity to assert my own views in here about the money market funds, where we started this conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we dealt with them adequately yet. I still think they're.
You mean right now we
right
haven't?
Right now.
Okay, no.
Right. So the SEC, when it put out its new rules, said these were first step, and I'm still waiting for the second step.
Okay. You also mentioned concern about within the Fed about off-balance sheet exposures. I was wondering, when was that concern and what was going on?
I'm not sure. So this is all conversations with people after the fact. And I
okay.
said, what did you know? Kind of, and they said, well, we were kind of worried about these things. We didn't know they would really come back on the balance. So I wasn't part of those discussions at the time.
All right. Bruce?
I just have a simple question. I mean, we went through you went through the Walter, I never know how to pronounce the guy's name, Badger?
Oh, Badger.
I'm glad that's cleared up. About, you know, when do you lend freely into a run, or lend right. freely, right. provided it's a solvent institution.
Right.
And there's been some controversy about what was going on with Lehman Brothers. So maybe you can talk about, or tell me a little about how the Fed reached its conclusion that it was insolvent.
Well,
we've heard stuff about New York Fed and back and forth, and that Sunday night, and maybe you could talk a little about what was going on.
Well, so I was down here in Washington. Yeah. I wasn't in New York, so I was sort of getting information from there. I think let me step back a little bit before getting the question. I think you raise an important point. In the middle of a panic, the line between solvency and liquidity is very difficult to determine. And you certainly can have liquidity failures of essentially solvent institutions. And after the failure, they may not be solvent because some of the assets they had, business lines and relationships, all of a sudden become insolvent, become worth less or even worthless. Therefore, you can't judge from the fact that what they were sold off for in the end is what they were worth. So it's very hard to determine, especially in a crisis when asset prices are moving fast and have liquidity premiums priced in. So this famous death spiral of people's net worth falling because the asset prices are falling, which causes people to sell, that's sort of fire sales, which Badgett was designed to prevent in the case of a commercial bank, to avoid the fire sales of assets and the downward spiral. I think in the case of Lehman, I don't know, all the information in hand to make a judgment whether it's solvent or not. But I do think that the fact that no private institution, maybe Barclays, but there was so little interest in buying it, that that had a lot of assets on its balance sheet that were difficult to price and highly risky, that they'd had trouble getting rid of, suggested that it really didn't have enough collateral to meet the Federal Reserve's criteria of adequately collateralized lending, that there was a hole there that it couldn't fill when it went out to raise capital, that other institutions saw and didn't want to try to fill. So I think there was every every indication that the company was insolvent.
But as a view of the Fed as being the lender of last resort, it would seem like that would be, you know, a place you would step into.
Not if it's insolvent. So this is exactly the Badgett point. And in addition, I think this was not a decision that was going to be made just by the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. It was made by the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury, with the Treasury in the lead, really. And I think it would have been a mistake in governance, in a democracy, if the Treasury had said, we don't have a buyer here, we don't have any choice, and the Federal Reserve had defied the Secretary of the Treasury and said, we're going to step in and lend and try and keep this guy alive for a few more days. That doesn't sound right to me. That's not...
So we're just about out of time. I don't know if you have a last question.
Steve had one.
Okay.
I read... What was the title of the paper that you...
What are your papers? Housing, right. Wealth. You did a paper with Karen Dinan, I think?
Yes.
2007.
Yes. I read that last night. I'm not an economist.
I don't remember everything that was in it.
That's all right. But what struck me was that as I was looking at it, there are lots of examples of household wealth or of households. And my job here is to help write a book for the people who are in these households. So looking at it from the other end. And toward the end of the book, one of the things we want to discuss is, I think, something that I began to develop a sense of clarity about in that paper, is this, it seems to be a relationship of a wealth effect and credit and confidence. They're all interrelated. And, of course, you wrote that paper, I think, in 2007 or something like that. A lot has happened since, and I would think the crisis has disrupted that cycle. Can you talk about that for a second?
Well, I think that's right. I don't remember the details of the paper, and I haven't read it since 2007. But it was about the buildup of debt backed by mortgages. So we try to look at what was building the debt up, and it was mortgage housing related. So I think you put your finger on an important sort of feedback mechanism here. The price of houses was going up. That was making households feel wealthier. They were saving less out of current income. They were accumulating debt backed by mortgage debt, some with poor underwriting standards on the mortgages. And everybody was kind of relaxed about this process because house prices were going up. And the borrower thought he or she could refinance at a lower interest rate and take some more cash out because the price of the house would go up. The lender thought they didn't have to pay any attention to the ability of the borrower to repay the loan because the price of the house would go up. The borrower defaulted. Lender wasn't going to lose anything. So I think there was a cycle of complacency by households and by borrowers and lenders of over-leveraging, both on the household side, which is what that paper was about, and on the lender side, based on that complacency and the over-reliance on housing wealth in the housing market.
This may be a very obvious question, but how has the crisis altered that cycle?
Well, at least for now, terrifically, because with the decline in the price of houses, households are obviously facing very severe problems, and they have to rebuild their wealth and rebuild their balance sheets. They've had to go back to saving the old-fashioned way, which is spend less of the money you get every month. And so whereas the savings rate out of current disposable income was less than 2% in the 1% to 2% range from, you know, about six years ago, it's now close to 6%. And that, so households are trying to rebuild their balance sheets, heal the problems caused by the decline in housing prices and the debt by saving more, by paying down debt, and they certainly spending less, and that's been a huge headwind for the U.S. economy. It's very hard to fight, to have an economy growing rapidly, when every dollar that comes around, which households used to spend 98 cents of, now they spend 97.654, right? So every time it comes around, there's less and less being spent. That's been a real impediment to growth in the United States, but it's absolutely necessary to build a sounder financial foundation for the households. On the lender side, many of the more egregious lending practices have been outlawed. The lenders have gone out of business. Many of those lenders, the ones that haven't gone out of business, suffered the shareholders and the managers of those institutions took major losses, and the regulators, so I think the regulators also have learned lessons and are being much tougher on this process. The legislators learn lessons about gaps in legislation, in regulation. The regulators learn lessons. So I think we're in a much safer place now, less dependent on this leverage, but it's a very difficult transition that's had a tremendous cost for the U.S. economy.
It seems asymmetric in the sense that you can get into the problem fast and it takes forever to get out of it.
That's the history of these debt problems. Reinhardt and Rogoff books about what's happened in the past when you have banking debt related problems and you have balance sheets that need to be rebuilt and banking systems, or in this case, given this, the spare tire was also down, financial systems that need to be rebuilt. It takes time to do that. So the costs have been quite severe from this thing. It's not surprising that it's taking a long time, but there's a huge cost to society.
Can confidence come back before the wealth comes back?
I think it'll be. I think they'll tend to. First of all, I don't think the wealth will ever. I hope the wealth doesn't come back the way it was before. So we don't need another housing bubble where houses are way overvalued. So we need to build our confidence on a more sustainable model in which, as a country, we're borrowing less from abroad, for example, smaller current account deficit, relying more on investment, more on exports, less on building houses, less on building fancy new financial instruments that don't serve anybody any good, and less on consumption more generally. We came into the recession. The recession was caused by overbuilding in houses, cars, financial instruments, all kinds of things. So we need to spend less on that stuff, more on capital investment.
What are the implications for the banking system of less credit?
I think the banking system, the implications over the long run, not next year or the year after, it's going different ways. So I think the fact that there's the total flow of credit is less means there are, I think, fewer profit opportunities, but presumably less variation in that. But for the banking system per se, I think the securitization markets will be smaller. So a higher proportion of that lower total should flow through the banks. Now,
you mean depository?
Depository, yes.
Okay.
Banks.
Right.
Right. Rather than shadow banks, right?
Right.
Not a
right.
Former Fed governor calls them bank banks. That's
right. Instead of non-bank banks, we've been through that one too. So I think they'll get a higher proportion of the smaller total credit flows, but it'll also be somewhat more costly because they'll have to fund more of it with capital and less of it with deposits. So there are a lot of conflicting things here. Now, the cost will in the end be passed on to the customers. The customers want to lend short and borrow long. Mm-hmm. That's what households like to do. They like to hold deposits and borrow 30-year mortgages, right?
the financial system accommodates that, but there was too damn much of it. And one of the things that the lessons here and the higher capital requirements, the Dodd-Frank restrictions will all raise the cost of intermediation, and there'll be less of that stuff going on. It'll be less profitable. Net-net, where the banks come out is hard, I think it's very, very hard to tell. But it's not all one way, because I think some of the, there's less air in the spare tire, or whatever that metaphor, the spare, it's one of those little spare tires rather than one of the big spare tires now.
Years ago, I met a man, his name was Henry Goldberg. He started on the Curve Exchange. He became a specialist on the New York Stock Exchange, and I said to him after all those years, I asked him in my naive way, if there's a word to describe the stock market, what would you say? He looked at me and almost instantly, this was a guy who presumably knew everything there was to know. He said, treacherous. Is there a word that, that comes to mind to describe the financial crisis?
No, I don't know. Whatever word I would say, I would regret later. So it was, there were lots of words.
I'll take two words or three words. Again, for the households. We're talking households here.
I think it was, I don't know, one word here. It had severe impacts. It was very harmful to households and businesses. Destroyed jobs. Made it more, put many households, some households knew they were doing sort of taking risks, but many households didn't understand. These are complex financial instruments, some of these mortgages. And I think people got caught up in the frenzy. I think the crisis obviously has had, and it's impeded the flow of credit through the system in such a way as the system, at the point you were getting at before, the system is coming back very slowly. So this unemployment, this lost output, lost jobs, postponing of family formation and things like that are, it's going to take a while for that to go away. So it had a very substantial cost in many dimensions for households. It's always, my view from inside the Fed was that the actions we took, the unusual actions we took, extraordinary actions we took, were to help lessen the cost for households. That was in my mind in all these things. So we are often accused of trying to protect the institutions, the shareholders, the managers, this, that, and the other thing. But that wasn't what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite certain that's not what Ben Bernanke was trying to do. I mean, this was about trying to insulate Main Street to some extent, or cushion the effects of the collapse on Wall Street from Main Street. And we weren't entirely successful, but I think it would have been hugely worse if we hadn't done what we did.
One, so that would be a good place to wrap, unless you have one
more. Going back to the issue of lowering interest rates and Main Street, 2005, Raghuram Rajan, gave this paper, and one of the things that he said was that providing this liquidity in crises was not costless, that it imposed a cost on savers, in the sense that small savers, people who keep their money in bank accounts. What was your thought about that?
I think, and it's still an issue today. So I think the low, anything we do always has costs and benefits.
Right.
And the low interest rates do affect folks who have been saving and aren't borrowing so much. So the extent households are borrowing, they're borrowing at much lower rates than they were a few years ago. The extent that they're lending, they're lending at much lower rates than they were a few years ago. But the alternative of having higher interest rates, to me, would mean fewer jobs. So it's true that the people who saved a lot aren't getting as much income from mm-hmm. their savings, but there are people out there, even at the 9.5% unemployment rate, that the unemployment rate would be 10.5%, 11.5%, 12.5% if we hadn't lowered the interest rates. Right. We got letters, I can remember letters, in the early 90s when interest rates were 3%, the funds rate, and they were heartrending letters of, my husband was a veteran, I've worked all my life, I've saved all my life, and I can't live on these low interest rates you have. But the counterfactual, well, if we raised interest rates, yes, it would help you, but it would hurt some others, and it would mm-hmm. hurt the economy. So it's unfortunate that we're in a situation in which the greater good implies some people aren't as well off as they otherwise would be, but we're paid as policymakers to look at the whole picture.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much. Thank
can
you.
I get back, if I have a further question about this relationship of wealth and confidence,
yes.
can I get back
yeah,
to
yeah.
you?
One question that we usually ask is there anything we haven't talked about that you would like to mention
no.
or talk about? No,
no.
We've covered everything.
I think we've covered lots of things.
Okay.